Welcome to the deep dive. Especially for all of you heading into pediatric nursing, or maybe you're already there, this session is really, really important.
Absolutely.
We're zeroing in today on infectious and communicable diseases in kids. Mm-hmm. It's fundamental stuff for providing good care.
It really is. Think of this as a way to get a solid handle on why little ones are just more prone to getting sick and what we as nurses can actually do about it. We've pulled together some key info to help build your confidence here.
Yeah, because their immune systems are basically learning on the job, aren't they? Facing all these new germs.
That's a perfect way to put it. So let's maybe unpack why babies and children are at higher risk.
Yeah.
Well, the big one is that immature immune system. Functionally, it just means they're not as quick or efficient at recognizing and fighting off pathogens compared to adults. We've had years to build up that defense library, you know.
Right. And newborns specifically have that decreased inflammatory response.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean practically, like when we're trying to spot an infection early?
Good question. So inflammation gives us those classic signs, redness, swelling, heat, right?
Uh-huh.
If that response is weaker, an infection could be getting started without those obvious flags. Make subtle assessment skills absolutely critical. You really have to look closely.
And then there's the lack of prior exposure, obviously, plus they lose the antibodies they got from mom. When's that key time, that vulnerability window?
Yeah, generally it's in those first few months. Maternal antibodies start to fade, but the baby's own system hasn't fully kicked into high gear yet.
Creates a gap.
Exactly. A window of increased susceptibility.
Okay. The source material also mentions cellular versus humoral immunity. Can you break that down simply for us? Why does that difference matter here?
Sure. So cellular immunity is kind of like the first line of defense present right from birth. It directly attacks infected cells. Think of it as the ground troops. Humoral immunity, though, that's more about building a specific response force. It produces targeted antibodies for specific germs, and that system really ramps up through exposure, either getting sick or through vaccines.
So it's under construction in young kids.
Pretty much, yeah. Still learning and building its arsenal.
Which brings us neatly to immunizations. We all know they're vital, but the protection isn't always instant or complete right away, is it? Why are boosters so essential then?
Think of the initial shots as laying the foundation. Boosters are like sending in reinforcements. They strengthen that initial immune memory, making the protection stronger and longer lasting as the child grows and encounters more things.
Makes sense. Okay, shifting gears slightly to the public health side. Reportable infections are mentioned, things like botulism, measles, meningococcus, even tracking deaths from varicella. Why is that surveillance piece so important?
It's absolutely crucial. When these specific diseases are diagnosed, it triggers a public health response. It allows authorities to track outbreaks, figure out how things are spreading,
and then put measures in place.
Precisely, like contact tracing, maybe targeted vaccination campaigns. It's all about protecting the wider community health. There's a CDC link in our notes for the full list, by the way.
Good. So we know why kids get sick more easily and why we track certain illnesses. But how did these infections actually spread? The chain of infection comes up. Can you walk us through that, maybe in a practical, nursing-focused way?
Yeah, let's break that chain. First link. The infectious agent. That's the bug itself, the virus, bacteria, whatever.
Got it.
Second, the reservoir. Where does that bug normally live and multiply? Could be a person, an animal, contaminated water, you name it.
Okay.
Third, portal of exit. How does the bug get out of the reservoir? Coughing, sneezing, blood, feces. Fourth, mode of transmission. How does it travel to someone new? Direct touch, droplets in the air, maybe tiny airborne particles. Contaminated surfaces, even insects, you know, vectors.
Oh, lots of ways.
Definitely. Fifth, portal of entry.
Mm-hmm.
How does it get into the next person? Breathing it in, swallowing it, a cut in the skin. And the final link, the susceptible host. Someone whose immune system isn't equipped to fight off that particular agent at that moment.
So, knowing those links, how do we use that as nurses? How do we break the chain?
That's the key. Each link is a potential point for intervention. Hand washing. That disrupts the mode of transmission, gets the agent off our hands.
Big one.
Huge. Immunizations make the host less susceptible. Using antibiotics wisely helps prevent resistant agents. Safe food handling deals with reservoirs and portals of entry. It's all connected.
It really paints a clear picture for prevention. Okay, let's talk about something super common. Fever. It worries parents, understandably. But physiologically, what's actually happening. Can you break down that process?
Sure. So an infection triggers the body to release these things called endogenous pyrogens.
Okay, pyrogens.
Think of them as signals. They travel to the brain, specifically to the hypothalamus, that's the body's thermostat. These pyrogens tell the hypothalamus, hey, turn up the heat. They do this by triggering prostaglandin production. Prostaglandins are the messengers that actually adjust the thermostat setting upwards.
So the body decides a higher temperature is the new normal temporarily?
Exactly. It resets its own set point. Then the body works to reach that new higher temperature. That's the cold response phase. Shivering generates heat. Blood vessels in the skin constrict to keep heat in.
That's why their hands and feet might feel cool even with a fever.
Precisely. Blood's being pulled inward. All these actions raise the body temperature until it hits that new target set by the hypothalamus.
Fascinating. Okay, so fever happens. When we suspect an infection, what's the core of our nursing assessment? What do we absolutely need to find out?
History first, always. When did symptoms start? How have they changed? Full immunization records, super important. Any known exposures? What about fluid intake and output? Are they unusually fussy, sleepy, just not themselves? That lethargy or malaise piece is key.
Right. Then the physical exam, what are we looking for? Inspection, observation?
You're looking everywhere carefully. Skin first, any rashes, spots, sores. Check the mouth and throat redness, swelling, exudate. Even hair and scalp for things like lice. Hydration status is critical look at mucous membranes, eyes, and of course, a full set of vital signs. Temp, heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure.
And palpation. What can touch tell us?
A lot, but gloves on first, always.
Always.
Feel the skin temp, warm, cool, clammy, texture. Check skin turgor, that elasticity test for hydration. Gently feel for any swollen or tender lymph nodes, especially around the neck, armpits, groin. That can point towards infection.
And this all happens within the context of infection control, right?
Yeah.
Isolation precautions.
Absolutely. Standard precautions are the baseline, treat everyone as potentially infectious.
Only.
Then, based on how a specific illness spreads, we add more. Contact precautions, gown and gloves for things spread by touch, like MRSA or C. diff.
Okay.
Droplet precautions need a mask for things spread by larger cough-sneeze droplets like flu or pertussis. And airborne precautions, special N95 mask, negative pressure room for tiny particles that hang in the air like measles or TB.
Got it. Are there specific assessment findings that are particularly important flags, things we really need to note?
Definitely. The type of rash is often a huge clue, its appearance, where it is. Palpable lymph nodes, as we mentioned. Skin turgor is a direct look at hydration and for dehydration signs, especially in babies. Sunken fontanelles, those soft spots.
Yeah.
Dry mouth, sticky mucous membranes. And that skin tenting, when you gently pinch the skin, does it snap back quickly or stay tented?
Key indicators. Okay, assessment done. What about diagnostic tests? What might get ordered?
Common ones include a CBC, the complete blood count. We look closely at the white blood cell count. Is it high? That suggests infection fighting, C-reactive protein or CRP, another marker for inflammation. A blood culture is vital if we suspect bacteria in the bloodstream, that's septicemia. Then, depending on symptoms, urine culture, maybe a spinal tap for CSF analysis if meningitis is a concern, stool cultures for GI bugs, cultures from IV lines, and a chest x-ray if pneumonia is suspected.
Okay. Quite a range. And common treatments.
Well, hydration is almost always key. Sometimes that means IV fluids if they can't drink enough or are losing too much. Antipyretics like acetaminophen or ibuprofen for fever and comfort. Antibiotics if it's bacterial. Specific antivirals for some viruses. And maybe antipyretics, anti-itch meds if there's a really bothersome rash or reaction.
Good overview. Now, let's dive into some of the really serious conditions. Sepsis. That's a word that gets everyone's attention.
As it should. Sepsis is critical. It's not just an infection somewhere. It's the body's overwhelming systemic response to that infection. It can be bacterial, fungal, viral.
But it's the body's response that's the problem.
Exactly. It goes haywire. Septicemia is specifically when there are microbes or toxins actually in the blood. Often gram-negative bacteria are involved there.
And the pathophysiology, how it progresses, sounds rapid and dangerous. Can you break that down?
Yeah. It is. Initially, you might get some vasoconstriction, the body trying to prioritize core organs, but that's quickly followed by massive vasodilation. Blood vessels relax and widen everywhere. Capillaries get leaky.
So fluid shifts out.
Fluid leaks out into tissues, blood pools in the veins. It leads to a major drop in blood pressure. That's septic shock.
Yeah.
Blood flow to vital organs plummets. They don't get oxygen. And you can rapidly get multi-organ failure. It's a cascade.
And infants under 3 months are highest risk. What bugs usually cause it in them?
Yeah, that age group is particularly vulnerable. Common culprits are things like E. coli, group B strep, and Haemophilus influenza type B Hib, though the vaccine has helped hugely with that one.
So for nurses caring for newborns, infants, what are those early, maybe subtle signs of sepsis we absolutely cannot miss?
Vigilance is key. Look for temperature instability, could be a high fever, or importantly, low temp hypothermia. Changes in behavior, really irritable, or the opposite, very lethargic, poor feeding. Heart rate often goes up early tachycardia, but late stage, it can drop dangerously low bradycardia. Tense or bulging fontanelles can signal increased pressure in the head. Skin signs, looking pale, maybe mottled. And check capillary refill press on a nail bed. Does the pink color return quickly? Longer than 3, maybe 4 seconds is a worry.
And in older kids?
Might present more like you'd expect.
Yeah.
Fever, stiff neck, just feeling awful, maybe a headache.
So if sepsis is suspected, what's the immediate game plan, tests and actions?
Diagnostics usually include that CBC with differential, blood culture definitely, your analysis and culture, maybe a Gram stain for a quick look, often a lumbar puncture for CSF if meningitis isn't ruled out, chest x-ray. But action-wise, the priorities are get IV access fast, give a fluid bolus to boost circulation, and start broad-spectrum antibiotics immediately, like right away. Don't wait for all the culture results.
Time is critical.
Absolutely. And continuous monitoring vital signs, urine output, watching for any sign of shock worsening.
Okay. Another really serious one, meningococcal disease, meningitis. What are the must-knows for nursing students?
First off, respiratory isolation. It spreads through respiratory secretions, coughing, sneezing, close contact.
Got it.
The person is considered contagious until they've had 24 hours of effective antibiotics. And thankfully, we have vaccines usually given around age 11 or 12 with a booster at 16.
What are the assessment red flags for meningitis?
Look for that combination. Fever, often changes in blood pressure, a really bad headache, irritability, that classic stiff neck, neutral rigidity. Altered mental status is a big one. Confusion, lethargy, photophobia, sensitivity to light. Sometimes a specific type of rash called petechiae, tiny purple or red dots that don't blanch when pressed. Nausea, vomiting, or just poor feeding in babies.
And the potential outcomes are severe.
Seizures, coma, permanent neurological damage, even death. It's an emergency.
So suspected meningitis, what are the nursing priorities straight away?
Frequent vitals and neurochecks are non-negotiable. Assess any rash carefully. Monitor for nausea, vomiting. But the absolute top cannot be delayed priorities are get cultures, blood and CSF ideally, and start antibiotics immediately. Everything else follows that.
Get the cultures, start the drugs.
Yes. Then manage the fever, supportive care, continuous close watching.
Okay. The source material also touches on viral infections, specifically viral exanthems. What falls into that category?
Exanthem just means rash. So these are common childhood viral illnesses known for causing characteristic rashes. Think mumps, measles, chickenpox, varicella zoster.
Right.
Roseola, which is sometimes called sixth disease, fifth disease, that slap cheek look from parvovirus B19, and hand, foot, mouth disease. All viral, all typically have a rash.
Good examples. Then we have vector-borne infections. What are those again, and which ones are common in kids?
Vector-borne means spread by something else, usually an insect or tick. In pediatrics, the big ones transmitted by ticks are Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. Need to be aware of those, especially in certain geographic areas.
And zoonotic diseases.
Those are ones that spread from animals to people. Kids can be at higher risk sometimes just because they interact closely with pets, maybe aren't as great with hand washing yet, and their immune systems are still developing.
Makes sense. Okay, let's talk parasites. Head lice and scabies are mentioned.
Right. Parasites live on or in a host. Head lice are tiny insects on the scalp, cause itching, spread easily head to head, pretty common in schools.
Uh-huh.
Scabies is caused by microscopic mites that burrow into the skin, causes intense itching, especially at night, and a specific kind of rash. It's very contagious through skin-to-skin contact, can be a real problem to get rid of sometimes.
How do we treat scabies? What should we know about the medications?
Treatment involves scabicides, drugs that kill the mites. Permethrin cream is very common. Lindane is another, though used more cautiously now. Ivermectin can be used, sometimes orally. Crotamitin, sulfur solution, there are options.
Now the itching.
Oh, the itching can persist even after the mites are dead. So antipruritics, antihistamines like divinhydramine, cetirizine, loratadine are often needed for relief.
What if they scratch so much they get a skin infection?
That definitely happens. Secondary bacterial infections are common. Then you need antibiotics, either topical like mupirocin or sometimes systemic ones. Occasionally, keratolytic creams might be used to help the scabicide penetrate thick or crusted skin. And crucially, treat the whole household, close contacts, wash everything hot.
Thorough approach needed.
Absolutely. Then there are helminthic infections, worms. What examples come up there? Things like pinworms, hookworms, roundworms. Pinworms are actually the most common worm infection in the U.S., especially in kids 5, 10 years old and their younger siblings. They spread easily.
Their source mentions giardiasis and enterobiasis specifically.
Right. Giardiasis isn't a worm, it's a protozoa, Giardia, often from contaminated water, common in daycare settings or places with sanitation issues. Causes GI upset, diarrhea, cramps, treated with drugs like metronidazole. Hand washing and safe water are key for prevention.
And enterobiasis.
That is pinworms. Nematodes. Eggs get under fingernails, spread easily hand to mouth, causes that intense anal itching, especially at night when female worms lay eggs. Treatment is usually a single dose of medication like mebendazole for kids over 2, maybe piperazine phosphate for younger ones. Often need to repeat the dose in 2 weeks and treat the whole family.
Okay, good to know. Finally, let's tackle pediatric dehydration. The materials stress how quickly this can become serious, even progress to shock. Why are kids so much more prone to it?
Several reasons physiologically. They just have a higher percentage of body weight as water compared to adults.
Okay.
And more of that water is in the extracellular space, which is lost more easily. Their metabolic rate is higher, so their baseline fluid needs are greater. They have a larger body surface area compared to their weight, meaning more fluid lost through skin and breathing, especially with a fever.
And their kidneys.
Still maturing. Not as good at concentrating urine and holding on to fluid when needed compared to adult kidneys. It all adds up to faster dehydration.
There's a table in the source showing severity levels. Can you walk us through the signs from mild to severe?
Sure. Mild dehydration. Child might be alert, maybe a little thirsty. Fontanelle's normal. Eyes look okay. Mouth is moist. Skin snaps back fine. Good turgor. Heart rate, BP, likely normal, maybe slightly less urine output.
Okay, it seems okay still.
Then moderate. Now they might be listless, maybe irritable. Fontanelles might be a bit sunken. Eyes look a little sunken too. Mouth is getting dry, sticky. Skin turgor is decreased tense slightly. Heart rate is up. BT might still be okay, but extremities might be cooler. Cap refill slower. Urine output definitely down.
Getting more worrying.
Yes, then severe. This is an emergency. Child could be lethargic, even comatose. Fontanelles and eyes deeply sunken. Mouth is parched, cracked, skin tense significantly. Heart rate is very high, or could be bradycardic if they're crashing. Blood pressure is low, that's shock. Extremities are cold, mottled, dusky. Cap refill is very delayed. Urine output is minimal or none.
That progression is critical to recognize early.
Absolutely critical.
One last point tied to fluids. Hyponatremia and hypernatremia, low and high sodium. Why is sodium balance so crucial, especially for the brain?
Sodium is key for nerve function, how nerve cells fire, transmit signals. That process is called depolarization. Hypernatremia, high sodium, can make nerves too excitable. Think seizures.
Okay.
Hyponatremia, low sodium, can decrease that excitability, leading to things like lethargy, confusion, even coma. But maybe even more importantly, sodium controls water movement. Water follows sodium.
Osmosis.
Right. The brain is incredibly sensitive to shifts in its water content. If sodium is low in the blood, hyponatremia, water can move into brain cells, causing them to swell. Brain swelling is incredibly dangerous because the skull doesn't expand.
Wow. Okay. That really highlights the importance of careful fluid management.
Yeah.
Well, this has been incredibly thorough, a really vital deep dive, especially aimed at you nursing students getting ready to care for kids with these conditions.
Yeah, it really shows how everything connects, doesn't it? Understanding that basic susceptibility, knowing the assessment flags, recognizing emergencies like sepsis or dehydration, and knowing the right interventions.
It's clear how foundational this knowledge is.
Yeah.
And combining with those sharp assessment skills and, good clinical judgment, that's what makes a great pediatric nurse.
Absolutely. It empowers you to make a real difference.
So as you all reflect on this, maybe one final thought to carry with you. We've talked a lot about the biology, the physiology, but Thinking about infants and children, what other factors, things beyond their bodies, like their environment, family situation, access to care, might impact their risk for infections and how they cope with illness? Something to consider as you move forward.
Great point. Well, we wish you all the very best on your nursing journey. It's important work you're preparing for.